This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Read. She is an extraordinary poet in all senses, both with the sensitivity of her craft and in the particular quality or the particular substance she gives to the actual content of being a woman, in no sense simply or clearly feminine, but very deeply from the roots of her own being. With relation specifically to her poems, I'd like to read what seems to me a very real characterization of their nature, taken from the comment of a poet whom she very highly respected and who returned that respect very actually. In a book published, I think it was 1944, William Carlos Williams made these comments about the character of poetry in his introduction. When a man makes a poem, makes it, mind you, he takes words as he finds them interrelated about him and composes them, without distortion which would mar their exact significances, into an intense expression of his perceptions and ardors, that they may constitute a revelation in the speech that he uses. It isn't what he says that counts as a work of art. It's what he makes with such an intensity of perception that it lives with an intrinsic movement of its own to verify its authenticity. Those of you who have read Miss Levertov's poetry, most recently published in The Jacob's Ladder, New Directions, and soon another collection happily is to come, O Taste and See, will know that this experience of poetry is most really and substantially to be found in her work. It is with very great pleasure that I introduce to you Miss Denise Levertov.
Thank you. I plan to read tonight mostly poems that will be in my new book, which will be out in a month or so. However, this poem is one which appeared in a magazine and somehow got inadvertently left out of the book. It's called Living with a Painting. It ripens while I sleep afternoons on the old sofa. The forms ready themselves for dazed, refreshed, wakening senses to bite on, taste with the mind's tongue. Yes, that confusion comes of sleep, and all was ripe before, and I green. Yet it's true, one who makes it, and one who needs it. The work ripens within the temper of living round about it, that brings as tribute, as rain, many awakenings, until a once cold arbitrary violet reveals itself as radiance, a defining halo, and discovered geometries in interplay show in their harvest time vase, lute, beaker. I want to check this thing now. Am I audible? Like over there? And how about over there? Thank you. The message. Cross country, out of sea fog, comes a letter in dream. A bard claims from me, on whose land they grow, seeds of the forget-me-not. I ask you to gather them for me, says the spirit of poetry. The varied blue in small compass, in multitude a cloud of blue, a river beside the brown river. Not flowers, but their seeds I am to send him. And he bids me remember my nature, speaking of it as of a power, and gather the flowers, and the flowers of Labor, pink in the dream, a bright centauri with more petals. Or the form changes to a sea pink. Ripple of blue in which are distinct blues. Bold centaur, seahorse, salt carnation, flower of work and transition. Out of sea fog, from a hermitage, at break of day. Shall I find them, then, here on my own land, recalled to my nature? Oh, Great Spirit. This is a poem from the Maine woods called The Breathing. An absolute patience. Trees stand up to their knees in fog. The fog slowly flows uphill. White cobwebs, the grass leaning where deer have looked for apples. The woods from brook to where the top of the hill looks over the fog, send up not one bird. So absolute it is no other than happiness itself, a breathing too quiet to hear. This poem is called September 61. That was the time when H.D. and William Carlos Williams were still alive, but in very bad shape, and Ezra Pound was very ill at that time. And very shortly afterwards, about 3 weeks after this poem was written, H.D. did die, and I dedicated this poem to her. I like to think that it's for William Carlos Williams too, though. September 61. This is the year the old ones, the old great ones, leave us alone on the road. The road leads to the sea. We have the words in our pockets. Obscure directions. The old ones have taken away the light of their presence. We see it moving away over a hill, off to one side. They are not dying. They are withdrawn into a painful privacy, learning to live without words. E.P., it looks like dying. Williams. I can't describe to you what has been happening to me. H.D., unable to speak. The darkness twists itself in the wind. The stars are small, the horizon ringed with confused urban light haze. They have told us the road leads to the sea and given the language into our hands. We hear our footsteps each time a truck has dazzled past us and gone, leaving us new silence. One can't reach the sea on this endless road to the sea unless one turns aside at the end, it seems, follows the owl that silently glides above it, aslant, back and forth, and away into deep woods. But for us, the road unfurls itself. We count the words in our pockets. We wonder how it will be without them. We don't stop walking. We know there is far to go. Sometimes we think the night wind carries a smell of the sea. Thank you. love song. Your beauty, which I lost sight of once for a long time, is long, not symmetrical, and wears the earth colors that make me see it. A long beauty, what is that? A song that can be sung over and over, long notes or long bones. Love is a landscape the long mountains define but don't shut off from the unseeable distance. In fall, your trees stretch their long arms in sleeves of earth red and sky yellow. I take long walks among them. The grapes that need frost to ripen them are amber and grow deep in the hedge, half concealed, the way your beauty grows in long tendrils, half in darkness. The next three poems are three short poems that belong together in some way. Song for Ishtar. The moon is a sow and grunts in my throat. Her great shining shines through me, so the mud of my hollow gleams and breaks in silver bubbles. She is a sow, and I a pig and a poet. When she opens her white lips to devour me, I bite back, and laughter rocks the moon. In the black of desire, we rock and grunt, grunt and shine. The Elves. Elves are no smaller than men, and walk as men do in this world, but with more grace than most, and are not immortal. Their beauty sets them aside from other men and from women, unless a woman has that cold fire in her called poet. With that, she may see them, and by its light they know her and are not afraid, and silver tongues of love flicker between them. The ache of marriage. The ache of marriage. Thigh and tongue, beloved, are heavy with it. It throbs in the teeth. We look for communion and are turned away, beloved, each and each. It is Leviathan, and we, in its belly, looking for joy, some joy not to be known outside it. Two by two in the arc of the ache of it. Kingdoms of Heaven. Paradise, an endless movie. You walk in, sit down in the dark, it draws you into itself. Slowly, an old man crosses the field of vision, his passions gathering to the brim of his soul, and grasses bow and straighten, the pulse of wind irregular, gleam of twilight. Anything. The attention never wavers. A woman, say, who is sleeping or laughing or making coffee. A marriage. Stir of time, the sequence returning upon itself, branching a new way. To suffer, pains, hope. The attention lives in it as a poem lives, or a song going under the skin of memory. Or to believe it's there within you, though the key's missing, makes it enough? As if golden pollen were falling onto your hair from dark trees. Sparks. In today's mail, a poem quotes from Ecclesiastes. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. A letter with it discloses in its words and between them a life opening, fearful, fearless, thousand-eyed, a field of sparks that move swiftly in darkness to and from a center. He is beginning to live. The threat of world's end is the old threat. Prepare for the world to come as thou shouldst die tomorrow, says the Book of Delight. And prepare for this world as thou shouldst live forever. This poem is called A Cure of Souls. I don't know if everybody knows that the word curate, which nowadays is usually taken to be the assistant priest of a parish, really comes from, it means he who has in his care the souls. It's a cure of souls. And cure and care really mean the same thing. But I wasn't thinking of a priest. As a matter of fact, I had in mind a rather humble psychologist that I knew who was working with groups and really cared about them and who perhaps in our time for many people has taken on something of that which a priest in his pastoral office has. And I was thinking of this man working in this time with the threat of the bomb always over everyone's head and the sense of futility that comes over everyone from time to time because of that. And his care for the current problems of these people. And it really ties in with the poem before, because this man was helping these people, and there are not just this one man, but many, many others. And not only psychologists and not only priests, but anyone who has people in their care is really himself preparing for this world as thou shouldst live forever and helping them do so. I don't really approve of making long speeches before reading a poem, and it's not my usual habit to do so, but excuse me. A Cure of Souls. The pastor of grief and dreams guides his flock towards the next field with all his care. He has heard the bell tolling, but the sheep are hungry and need the grass today and every day. Beautiful his patience, his long shadow, the rippling sound of the flock moving along the valley. poems, like those I've just read, was written in the spring of 62. And is in a certain sense a political poem. It does refer to the bomb tests that were taking place at that time, and about which, because we don't have any open-air bomb tests, we've all gotten rather sort of unconscious since the test ban treaty, but it's just as well to remember that that's not a complete test ban treaty, and that the testing which is going on underneath the earth is also very harmful. Another spring. In the gold mouth of a flower, the black smell of spring earth. No more skulls on our desks, but the pervasive testing of death, as if we had need of new ways of dying. No. We have no need of new ways of dying. Death in us goes on testing the wild chance of living as Adam chanced it. Golden mouth, the tilted smile of the moon westering is at the black window, calavera of spring. Do you mistake me? I'm speaking of living, of moving from one moment into the next and into the one after, breathing death in the spring air, knowing air also means music to sing to. The film. Turtle goddess. She of the hard shell, soft underneath, awaits enormously in a dark grotto the young heroes. Then the corridor of booths, in each life enshrined in veils of light, scenes of bliss or dark action. Honey and fog, the nose confused. And at the corridor's end, two steps down into nothing. The film is over. We're out in the street. The filmmaker's wife grieves and tells him, goodbye forever. You were wrong, wrong to have shown the turtle mother. The darkness should not be revealed. Farewell. Maker of visions, he walks with me to the gate of home and leaves me. I enter. Mother is gone. Only things remain. So be it. This poem is in some sense related to the one that I just read. Above the cave. The cave downstairs. Jet, obsidian, ember of bloodstone, glisten of mineral green. And what hangs out there, asleep. If a serpent were singing, what silence? Sleeping, sleeping. It is the thunder of the serpent, drum roll of the mounting smell of gas, unable to wake, to blurt out the unworded warning. Ah! Transformed. A silence of waking at night into speech. I think the relation between the two poems I've just read is that they both are poems of transition or initiation. They were written around the same time, and I was. I did read the film just before reading the one I just read, didn't I? I don't mean that it relates to Another Spring. I mean that the film and the one called Above the Cave are related to one another. This is quite a different kind of poem called The Secret. Two girls discover the secret of life in a sudden line of poetry. I, who don't know the secret, wrote the line. They told me, through a third person, they had found it, but not what it was, not even what line it was. No doubt, by now, more than a week later, they have forgotten the secret, the line, the name of the poem. I love them for finding what I can't find, and for loving me for the line I wrote, and for forgetting it so that 1,000 times till death finds them, they may discover it again in other lines, in other happenings, and for wanting to know it, for assuming there is such a secret. Yes, for that most of all. Leaving forever. He says the waves in the ship's wake are like stones rolling away. I don't see it that way, but I see the mountain turning away its face as the ship takes us away. This is a somewhat longer poem called To the Muse. I've heard it said, and by a wise man, that you are not one who comes and goes, but having chosen, you remain in your human house and walk in its garden for air and the delights of weather and seasons. Who builds a good fire in his hearth shall find you at it with shining eyes and a ready tongue. Who shares even water and dry bread with you will not eat without joy. And wife or husband who does not lock the door of the marriage against you finds you not as unwelcome third in the room, but as the light of the moon on flesh and hair. He told me, that wise man, that when it seemed the house was empty of you, the fire crackling for no one, the bread hard to swallow in solitude, the gardens a tedious maze, you were not gone away, but hiding yourself in secret rooms. The house is no cottage, it seems. It has stairways, corridors, cellars, a tower perhaps, unknown to the host. The host, the housekeeper, it is, who fails you. He had forgotten to make room for you at the hearth, or set a place for you at the table, or leave the doors unlocked for you. Noticing you are not there, when did he last see you? He cries out to you, you are faithless, have failed him, writes you stormy letters demanding you return. It is intolerable to maintain this great barracks without your presence. It is too big, it is too small, the bulls menace him, the fire smokes and gives off no heat. But to what address can he mail the letters? And all the while, you are indwelling, a gold ring lost in the house. A gold ring lost in the house. You are in the house. Then what to do to find the room where you are? Deep cave of obsidian glowing with red, with green, with black light, high room in the lost tower where you sit spinning, crack in the floor where the gold ring waits to be found. No more rage, but a calm face. Trim the fire, lay the table, find some flowers for it. Is that the way? Be ready with quick sight to catch a gleam between the floorboards, there where he had looked 1,000 times and seen nothing. Light of the house, the wise man spoke words of comfort. You are near. Perhaps you are sleeping and don't hear. Not even a wise man can say, do thus and thus, that presence will be restored. Perhaps, a becoming aware, a door is swinging as if someone had passed through the room a moment ago. Perhaps, looking down, the sight of the ring back on its finger. Wouldn't some of the people still standing in the doorway like to come in and sit on the floor while I drink a glass of water? It seems to me there are a few perches on this sort of shelf over there. Yeah.
Why don't we take a short break?
I'm reading these poems more or less in chronological order tonight, and it makes me realize how sometimes an image from one poem will carry over quite unconsciously into the next poem that one writes. For instance, the crack in the floor in the poem that I just read is functioning in the same way, I think, as the crack in the window in the poem I'm going to read, which is called The Crack. While snow fell carelessly, floating indifferent in eddies of rooftop air, circling the black chimney cowls, a spring night entered my mind through the tight-closed window, wearing a loose Russian shirt of light silk. For this, then, that slanting line was left, that crack, the pain never replaced. It's almost like saying that if you don't have a crack in the floor, the gold ring hasn't any place to roll into. Figure of time. Old day, the gardener seemed death himself, or time, scythe in hand, by the sundial and freshly dug grave in my book of parables. the mignonette, the dusty miller, and silvery rocks in the garden next door thrived in his care. The rocks not hidden by weeds, but clear cut between tufts of fern and saxifrage. Now by our pear tree with pruning hook, now digging the Burns's neat, weedless rose beds, or as he peered at a bird in Mrs. Peach's laburnum, his tall, stooped person appeared and gray curls. He worked slow and in silence, and knew perhaps every garden around the block, gardens we never saw, each one bounded by walls of old brick, a square plot that was world to itself. When I was grown and gone from home, he remembered me in the time of my growing and sent year by year salutations until there was no one there in changed times to send them by. Old day, old death, dusty gardener, are you alive yet? Do I live on yet in your gray considering eye? The resolve. To come to the river, the brook hurtles through rainy woods, overtopping rocks that before the rain were islands. Its clearness is gone, and the song. It is a rich brown, a load of churned earth goes with it. The sound now is a direct, intense sound of direction. Overheard. A deep wooden note when the wind blows, the west wind. The rock maple, is it, close to the house? Or a beam, voice of the house itself? A groan, but not gloomy, rather an escaped note of almost unbearable satisfaction, a great bough or beam, unaware it had spoken. Claritas. 1. This has numbered sections, but I think I won't read the numbers. I'll just pause in between the sections. The all-day bird, the artist, white-throated sparrow, striving in hope and good faith to make his notes ever more precise, closer to what he knows. There is the proposition and the development, the way one grows from the other. The all-day bird ponders. May the first note be round enough, and those that follow fine, fine as sweet grass, praise the all-day bird. Fine as the tail of a lizard, as a leaf of chives, the shadow of a difference, falling between note and note, a hair's breadth defining them. The dew is on the vine leaves. My tree is lit with the break of day. Sun, light, 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 light. Shalom. I guess most of you know that's the Hebrew greeting, peace, which is used as a common greeting, like hello and goodbye in Israel. A man growing old is going down the dark stairs. He has been speaking of the soul tattooed with the law, of dreams burnt in the bone. He looks up to the friends who lean out of light and wine over the well of stairs. They ask his pardon for the dark they can't help. Star-laden Babylon buzzes in his blood, an ancient pulse. The rivers run out of Eden. Before Adam blazes. It's all right, answers the man going down. It's all right. There are many avenues, many corridors of the soul that are dark also. Shalom. This poem, The Coming Fall, has also three parts. They're unnumbered parts. They're unnumbered because I didn't fill them as a sequence, but as rays going out of a center, so that it isn't one, two, and three in a sequential relationship, but three related parts. I'll pause between them. The coming fall. The eastern sky at sunset taking the glow of the west a clear stillness. The east flinging nets of cloud to hold the rose light a moment longer, the western hill dark to blackness. The ants on their acropolis prepare for the night. The vine among the rocks, heavy with grapes. The shadows of September among the gold glint of the grass. Among shining willow leaves, the small birds moving, silent in the presence of a new season. In the last sunlight, human figures dark on the hill outlined, a fur of gold about their shoulders and heads, a blur defining them. Down by the fallen fruit in the old orchard, the air grows cold. The hill hides the sun. A sense of the present rises out of earth and grass, enters the feet, ascends into the genitals, constricting the breast, lightening the head, a wisdom, a shiver, a delight that what is passing is here, as if a snake went by, green in the gray leaves. This poem is similarly slow-paced, I think. I know that this one is slow-paced. I first gave it a subtitle of Adagio, but I think the way it's written indicates the slowness of the pace, so I cut out the subtitle. And as the one I've just read is about sunset time, this is about very, very early dawn, sort of pre-dawn, the ground mist. In hollows of the land, in faults and valleys, the white fog, bruised by blue shadows, a mirage of lakes. and in the human faults and depths, silences, floating between night and daybreak, illusion and substance. But is illusion so repeated, known each dawn, silence suspended in the mind's shadow, always, not substance of a sort? The white, bruised ground mist, the mirage of a true lake. This is a quite different kind of poem, The Old Adam. A photo of someone else's childhood, a garden in another country, world he had no part in and has no power to imagine. Yet the old man who has failed his memory keens over the picture. Them happy days, gone, gone forever, glad for a moment to suppose a focus for unspent grieving, his floating sense of loss. He wanders, asking the day of the week, the time, over and over the wrong question. Missing his way in the streets, he acts out the bent of his life, the lost way never looked for, life unlived, of which he is dying very slowly. A man, says his son, who never made a right move in all his life. A man who thought the dollar was sweet and couldn't make a buck, riding the subway year after year to untasted sweetness. Loving his sons obscurely, incurious who they were, these men, his sons. A shadow of love, for love longs to know the beloved, and a light goes with it into the dark mine shafts of feeling. A man who now, without knowing, in endless concern for the smallest certainties, looking again and again at a paid bill, inquiring again and again, when was I here last? Asks what it's too late to ask. Where is my life? Where is my life? What have I done with my life? This poem has an epigraph from a mid-16th century poem attributed to J. Wedderburn, that says, who is at my window? Who? Go from my window. Go, go. Who calleth there so like a stranger? Go from my window. Go. Who is at my window? Who? It's the blind cuckoo mulling the old song over. The old song is about fear, about tomorrow and next year. Timor mortis conturbat me, he sings. What's the use? He brings me the image of when a boat hull down, smudged on the darkening ocean. I want to move deeper into today. He keeps me from that work. Today and eternity are nothing to him. His wings spread at the window make it dark. Go from my window. Go, go. That one, I guess, is a poem about angst. And this one is called Punyal, and is a poem about the worst happening, when the worst happens, actually happens. And Punyal means a dagger, and there's a poem of Lorca's that is called Punyal, and it has the refrain something like this, that, no, don't stick me with it, no. As if that hand, squeezing crow's blood, against a white sky beside an idiot's laughing face were real. Having set out in shoes that hurt by the bog road and missed the way, a cold day dragging to a cold end, the blood congealing black between the pleased fingers. This one is called O Taste and See, and it's the title poem of what will be my new book. O Taste and See. The world is not with us enough. O Taste and See, the subway Bible poster said, meaning the Lord. Meaning, if anything, all that lifts to the imagination's tongue, grief, mercy, language, tangerine, weather, to breathe them, bite, savor, chew, swallow, transform into our flesh our deaths, crossing the street, plum, quince, living in the orchard and being hungry and plucking the fruit. The line, all that lives to the imagination's tongue. And in the first poem that I read, this line that says, about it says the forms in the painting. The forms ready themselves for dazed, refreshed, wakening senses to bite on, taste with the mind's tongue. It refers to a line that I found somewhere in Ruskin and quoted in another poem in another book, a poem which was a partial translation from Gautier of his famous poem Art. And the whole phrase as quoted here was the mind's tongue that works and tastes into the very rock heart. I've always liked it very much. In abeyance. No skilled hands caress the stranger's flesh with lucid oil before a word is spoken. No feasting before a tale is told, before the stranger reveals his name. The ships come and go along the river and in and out of the narrows, and few among us know it. We are so many, and many within themselves travel to far islands, but no one asks for their story, nor is there an exchange of gifts stranger to stranger, nor libation, nor sacrifice to the gods, and no house has its home. Eros at Temple Stream. The river in its abundance, many-voiced, all about us as we stood on a warm rock to wash, slowly smoothing in long, sliding strokes, our soapy hands along each other's slippery, cool bodies, quiet and slow in the midst of the quick of the sounding river, our hands were flames, stealing upon quickened flesh until no part of us but was sleek and on fire. There's something going on behind that curtain. There's a whole other world in there. People are living there and
I think I should look. I think I'll have to drink some more water to sort of make a... I find it rather distracting, you know, to hear those voices behind me that way. Often, reading poems chronologically, there is this sense of poems going two by two, relating to one another, because of one's preoccupations at that time. But then I find poems often that have a distinct relation to a much earlier poem or a considerably earlier poem, so that I think of them together, although there are a lot of poems in between. This one, called The Novices, I feel has a relation of kind and of form also to the rather long one that I read called To the Muse. It's called The Novices. They enter the bare wood, drawn by a clear, obscure summons they fear, and have no choice but to heed. A rustling underfoot, a long trail to go, the thorn bushes grow across the dwindling paths, until the small clearing where they anticipate violence, knowing some rite to be performed and compelled to it. The man moves forward, the boy sees what he means to do. From an oak tree, a chain runs at an angle into earth, and they pit themselves to uproot it, dogged and frightened, to pull the iron out of the earth's heart. But from the further depths of the wood, as they strain and weigh on the great chain, appears the spirit, the wood demon who summoned them. And he is not bestial, not fierce, but an old woodsman, gnarled, shabby, smelling of smoke and sweat, of a bear's height and shambling like a bear. Yet his presence is a spirit's presence, and awe takes their breath. Gentle and rough, laughing a little, he makes his will known. Not for an act of force, he called them, for no rite of obscure violence, but that they might look about them and see intricate branch and bark, stars of moss, and the old scars left by dead men's sores, and not ask what that chain was. To leave the open fields and enter the forest, that was the right. Knowing there was mystery, they could go back now. And he receded among the multitude of forms, the twists and shadows they saw now, listening to the hum of the world's wood. The Stone Carver's poem. Hand of man, hewed from the mottled rock, almost touching as Adam the hand of God, smallest inviolate stone violet. Melody Grundy. Take me or leave me, cries Melody Grundy. I like my face. I am gaily alone. On my cast-iron horse, I was swiftly everywhere, and no one saw it for what it was. That was romance. I leaned on the mighty tree stump to watch an other life but play. That was joy. I wept. I leapt into my ship to sail over grass. Melody, plenty of friends elsewhere, doesn't care. We'll sing for all to hear. Gone away. When my body leaves me, I'm lonesome for it. I've got eyes, ears, nose and mouth, and that's all. Eyes keep on seeing the feather blue of the cold sky. Mouth takes in hot soup, nose smells the frost. Ears hear everything, all the noises and absences. But body goes away to I don't know where, and it's lonesome to drift above the space it fills when it's here. The disclosure. From the shriveling gray silk of its cocoon, a creature slowly is pushing out to stand clear. Not a butterfly, petal that floats at will across the summer breeze. Not a furred moth of the night, crusted with indecipherable gold. Some primal shaped, plain winged, day-flying thing. Into the interior. Mountain, 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 marking time, each nameless, wall beyond wall, wavering redefinition of horizon. And through the months, the arrivals at dusk in towns one must leave at daybreak. Were they taken to heart, to be seen always again, or let go, those faces? A door half open, moss by matchlight on an inscribed stone. And by day, through the hours that rustle about one dryly, tall grass of the savannah up to the eyes, no alternative to the one-man path. Threshold. A form upon the quilted overcast, gleam, sacré-cœur, salt-lick to the mind's desire. How shall the pulse beat out that measure, under devious moon, wander, swerving to wonder? Hands turn, what stone to uncover, feather of broken oracle? This is again a slightly longer one called the novel. My husband writes novels, and his method of working is to write on many, many sheets of paper, and he covers every possible surface, tables and shelves and floor. And at one point when he was going away for about 3 weeks, he said to me, go in and see if you read some of the stuff, see if you think there is a novel there. And I did think there was a novel there. And this poem came out of it. I didn't really read very much of the material, and I hadn't really discussed the book with him. So I don't want you to think that this is about his novel, But it's a poem that arose out of the of that novel being written. A wind is blowing. The book being written shifts, halts, pages yellow and white drawing apart and inching together in new tries. A single white half sheet skims out under the door. And cramped in their not yet half-written lives, a man and a woman grimace in pain. Their cat, yawning its animal secret, stirs in the monstrous limbo of erasure. They live, when they live, in fear of blinding, of burning, of choking under a mushroom cloud in the year of the roach. And they want, like us, the eternity of today. They want this fear to be struck out at once by a thick black magic marker everywhere, every page, the whole sheets of it crushed, crackling, and tossed in the fire. And when they were fine ashes, the stove would cool and be cleaned, and a jar of flowers would be put to stand on top of the stove in the spring light. Meanwhile, from page to page, they buy things, acquiring the look of a full life. They argue, make silence bitter, plan journeys, move house, implant despair in each other, and then in the nick of time, they save one another with tears, remorse, tenderness, hooked on those wonder drugs. Yet they do have, don't they? Like us, their days of grace, they halt, stretch. A vision breaks in on the cramped grimace, inscape of transformation. Something sundered begins to knit. By scene, by sentence, something is rendered back into life, back to the gods. About marriage. Don't lock me in wedlock. I want marriage, an encounter. I told you about the green light of May. A veil of quiet befallen the downtown park late Saturday afternoon. Long shadows and cool air, scent of new grass, fresh leaves. And the birds I met there, birds of passage breaking their journey, three birds, each of a different species. The azalea breasted with round poll, dark, the brindled merry mouse-gliding one, and the smallest, goldenest gorse, and wearing a black Venetian mask. And with them the three douce hen-birds, feathered in tender, lively brown. I stood a half hour under the enchantment. No one passed near. The birds saw me and let me be near them. It's not irrelevant. I would be met and meet you, so, in a green, airy space, not locked in. Looking glass. I slide my face along to the mirror sideways to see that side smile, a pale look, tired and sly. Hey, who is glancing there? Shadow me, not with malice, but mercurially shot with foreknowledge of dread and sweat. Hypocrite women. Hypocrite women, how seldom we speak of our own doubts while dubiously we mother man in his doubt. And if at Mill Valley, perched in the trees, the sweet rain drifting through western air, a white sweating bull of a poet told us our cunts are ugly. Why didn't we admit we had thought so too? And what shame, they are not for the eye. No, they are dark and wrinkled and hairy, caves of the moon. And when a dark humming fills us, a coldness towards life, we are too much women to own to such unwomanliness. Whorishly with the psychopomp, we play and plead, and say nothing of this later. And our dreams, with what frivolity we have pared them like toenails, clipped them like ends of split hair. In mind. There's in my mind a woman of innocence, unadorned but fair-featured and smelling of apples or glass. She wears a utopian smock or shift. Her hair is light brown and smooth, and she is kind and very clean without ostentation. But she has no imagination. And there's a turbulent, moon-ridden girl, or an old woman, or both, dressed in opals and rags, feathers and torn taffeta, who knows strange songs, but she is not kind. Our bodies, still young under the engraved anxiety of our faces, and innocently more expressive than faces. Nipples, navel, and pubic hair make anyway a sort of face. Or taking the rounded shadows at breast, buttock, balls, the plump of my belly, the hollow of your groin as a constellation, how it leans from earth to dawn in a gesture of play and wise compassion. Nothing like this comes to pass in eyes or wistful mouths. I have a line or groove I love runs down my body from breastbone to waist. It speaks of eagerness, of distance. Your long back, the sand color and how the bones show, say what sky after sunset, almost white, over a deep woods to which rooks are homing, says. The prayer. At Delphi I prayed to Apollo that he maintain in me the flame of the poem. And I drank of the brackish spring there, dazed by the gong beat of the sun, mistaking it as I shrank from the eagle's black shadow crossing that sky of cruel blue for the Pierian spring. And soon after, vomited my moussaka, and then my guts writhed for some hours with diarrhea, until at dusk, among the stones of the goat paths, breathing dust, I questioned my faith, or within it wondered if the god mocked me. But since then, though it flickers or shrinks to a blue bead on the wick, there's that in me that burns and chills, blackening my heart with its soot, flaring in laughter, stinging my feet into a dance, so that I think sometimes not Apollo heard me, but a different god. And the poem I've just read was written about 3 years after going to Greece. And then after writing the poem, I found that the temple at Delphi was, in fact, dedicated to Dionysus before it was Apollos. I'm going on rather a long time because I still have more poems I'd like to read. I do not know he's getting terrible pins and needles sitting on the floor. I think I'm going to pour out another glass of invaluable water and let everybody sort of stretch before I read the next one.
Sorry, but I don't remember.
You met him in Vancouver.
Oh, in Vancouver. Yes. Oh, yes. Now I know him. Yeah. Exactly. Right. Greetings.
Losing track. Long after you have swung back away from me, I think you are still with me. You come in close to the shore, on the tide, and nudge me awake the way a boat adrift nudges the pier. Am I a pier, half in, half out of the water? And in the pleasure of that communion, I lose track. The moon I watch goes down, the tide swings you away before I know I'm alone again long since. Mud sucking at gray and black timbers of me, a light growth of green dreams drying. This is a prose poem called The Runes, and it was literally given to me in a dream. I was a child in Finland in my dream, and I had to write down these ancient runes as part of my homework. I knew them by heart, and I wrote them out in my lesson book. One. Know the pine trees. Know the orange dryness of sickness and death in needle and cone. Know them, too, in green health, those among whom your life is laid. Two. Know the ship you sail on. Know its timbers. Deep the fjord waters where you sail. Steep the cliffs. Deep into the unknown coast goes the winding fjord. But what would you have? Would you be tied up to a sand-white quay in perpetual sunshine, yards and masts sprouting little violet mandolins? Three. In city, in suburb, in forest, no way to stretch out the arms. So if you would grow, go straight up or deep down. A turn of the head. Quick, there's that low, brief whirr to tell Ruby Throat is at the tiger lilies. Only a passionate baby sucking breast milk so intent. Look sharply after your thoughts, said Emerson, a good dreamer. Worlds may lie between you and the bird's return. Hummingbird stays for a fractional sharp sweetness and's gone. Can't take more than that. The remaining tiger blossoms have rolled their petals all the way back. The stamens protrude entire. There are no more buds. Earth Psalm. I could replace God for a while, that old ring of candles, that owl's wing brushing the dew off my grass hair. If bended knee calls up a god, if the imagination of idol calls up a god, if melting of heart or what was written as bowels but has to do not with shit but with salutation of somber beauty in what is mortal calls up a god by recognition and power of longing, then in my forest God is replaced a while I can turn from that slow embrace to worship mortal, the summoned god who has speech, who has wit, to wreathe all words, who laughs, wrapped in sad pelt and without hope of heaven, who makes a music, turns the heads of all beasts, as mine turns, dream hill grass, standing on end at echo even. A psalm praising the hair of man's body. My great brother, Lord of the song, wears the ruff of forest there. Husband, thy fleece of silk is black, a black adornment. Lies so close to the turns of the flesh, burns my palm stroke. My great brother, Lord of the song, where's the ruff of forest bear? Strong legs of our son are dusted dark with hair. Told of long roads, we know his stride. My great brother, Lord of the song, where's the ruff of forest bear? Hair of man, man hair, hair of breast and groin, marking contour as silver point marks in cross hatching as river, grass on the woven current indicates ripple, praise. A march. In those wine and urine-stained hallways, something in me wondered, what will become of all that black beauty? That's from James Baldwin. Out of those hallways, crossing the street to blue astonished eyes, as though by first light made visible, dark presences slowly focus. Revelation of tulip blacks, delicate browns, proportion of heavy lip to beveled temple bone. The mind of a fair man at the intersection jars at the entering of this beauty, filing endlessly through his blue blinking eyes into the world within him. Seed time. There are weeds that flower forth in fall in a gray cloud of seed that seems, from a not-so-great distance, plum blossom, pear blossom, or first snow. As if in a fog of feather light, goose-down silvery seed thoughts, a rusty mind in its autumn, reviewed, renewed, its winged power. There are four more poems. They're all pretty short. This one has as yet no title. Like dogs in Mexico, furless, sore, misshapen, arrives from laborious nowhere agony and proves to have eyes of kindness, a pitiful tale, wants love. Give it some in form of dry tortilla, It grabs and runs off three-legged, scared, but tarries nearby and will return a friend. Face to face. A nervous smile as gaze meets gaze across deep river. What place for a smile here? It edges away. Leaves us each at ravine's edge, alone with our bodies. We plunge. Oh, dark river. Towards each other, into that element, a deep fall. The eyes closing as if forever, the air ripping, the waters cleaving and closing upon us. Heavy we are, our flesh of stone and velvet goes down, goes down. This is another one with as yet no title. Grief. Have I denied thee? Grief, I have denied thee. That robe or tunic, black gauze over black and silver, my sister wore to dance sorrow, hung so long in my closet. I never tried it on. And my dance was summer. They rouged my cheeks and twisted roses with wire stems into my hair. I was compliant. Juno de 7 ans, betraying my autumn birthright pour faire plaisir. Always denial. Grief in the morning, washed away in coffee, crumbled to a dozen errands between busy fingers. Or across cloistral shadow, insistent intrusion of pink sunstripes from open archways, falling recurrent. Corrosion denied. The figures the acid designs filled in. Grief dismissed, and Eros along with grief. Phantasmagoria swept across the sky by shaky winds endlessly, the spaces of blue timidly steady, blue curtains at trailer windows framing the cinder walks. There are hidden corners of sky choked with the swept shreds, with pain and ashes. Grief, have I denied thee, the emblems torn from the walls and the black plumes. And this is the last one I'll read. The mutes. Those groans men use, passing a woman on the street or on the steps of the subway, to tell her she is a female and their flesh knows it. Are they a sort of tune, an ugly enough song sung by a bird with a slit tongue, but meant for music? Or are they the muffled roaring of deaf mutes trapped in a building that is slowly filling with smoke? Perhaps both. Such men most often look as if groan were all they could do, yet a woman, in spite of herself, knows it's a tribute. If she were lacking all grace, they'd pass her in silence. So it's not only to say she's a warm hole. It's a word in grief language, nothing to do with primitive, not an Ur language, language stricken, sickened, cast down in decrepitude. She wants to throw the tribute away, disgusted, and can't. It goes on buzzing in her ear. It changes the pace of her walk. The torn posters in echoing corridors spell it out. It quakes and gnashes as the train comes in. Her pulse sullenly had picked up speed, but the cars slow down and jar to a stop while her understanding keeps on translating. Life after life after life goes by, without poetry, without seemliness, without love. Thank you.